everybody. Welcome to this week's Power Up. I am here joined by the lovely Maude Garrett. I did the right side this time.
Hi. I probably won't. You know me.
High five.
Life can be hard.
Virtual high five.
Damn it! It's 50-50!
Yes! Yes!
Oh, we are powering up, all right. Yes, we are chatting all things playing, watching, and reading. And we managed to rope in a pretty impressive guest that you have seen on your small screens and even your big screens and all of the screens that play tabletop. Mm-hmm. So if you love D&D or if you love We're Alive or if you've even been some of the bomber backers that played with you just before with Among Us and have many, many things to say, please welcome our guest today. We have the one and only Vince Casso. Hey, buddy.
Oh, hi.
Welcome, Vince.
How's it going, y'all?
I was going to say, too, L.A. by Night, shout out, and the Guild.
Yeah, L.A. by Night, the Guild. Yeah, I'm probably most well known for the Guild at this stage, but yeah, it's all kinds of fun stuff.
Can I tell you, Vince, my husband knows you as my friend Vince, and we watched the Guild, I forget how many months ago, but anyway, he had no idea it was the same person.
Yeah.
Because you look so different as Blades.
Yeah, well, I was 15 in season one when we shot that, yeah. Yeah, and I'm 28 now, so do the math on how old that show is.
Yeah. It's old, but like, what a pioneer in web series, and especially nerd content web series. How did you originally get linked up with the Guild and with Felicia?
Well, so originally the Guild was written to be an actual half-hour comedy pilot. Pretty much like the entirety of, or the bulk of season one was written to kind of be one episode. And she casted it very much like you would an ordinary television series. So I just showed up for the audition, my agent got me the gig, walked in, did my bit. They were not expecting my type for that role, but they just liked the smarmy, kind of sticky character that I brought to it, and that was that. We did a table read at her house at that point, and then it then turned into a web series from that point forward.
So how old would Felicia have been when she wrote and made that happen, if you're now...
Not old. I couldn't tell you.
Ago? So probably her mid to late 20s?
We were honestly all pretty young. Amy was just like getting into college. Everyone else was in their 20s, except for Jeff, whose age is infinite.
Yeah, that's awesome. And now the rest is history. And now you guys are all playing D&D. So is your D&D character that you're currently playing as a 180 from Blades?
Well, okay. So with the Guild's D&D show, we're all supposed to be playing like fantasy versions of our characters from the show, but it's hard to play Blades the way he would actually be in that setting because he's not a likable person and is written to kind of be the butt of the joke a lot. So I'm kind of just playing myself, honestly, just hyperbolized, which is what I often enjoy doing.
We've spoken D&D before as well. It's kind of like how we...
Yeah, you and I wrote a one-shot.
We certainly did. How cool is that? I want to talk about the fact that D&D has taken off and you are able to play a lot. How have you kind of used this involuntary downtime to explore a lot of tabletop scenarios?
Totally. So, well, for me, I actually had not played a single game of D&D until 2018. My first ever game of D&D was at the table of Kelly D'Angelo as DM for her home game. And from there, I started playing a regular home game with Jake Michaels, who was also the director for We're Alive. And we played that for the better part of a year. And from there, I'm like, you know what? I enjoy playing. I like the process of it, but DMing actually attracts me much more. And I started my own home game. I designed my entire own homebrew world, which I now DM that series every week. And also just started running a home game with my friends. You know, Alex Ward, Sage Ryan, a lot of other cool people in our community are just in there playing the game on our off time. And the pandemic, counterintuitively, the pandemic honestly made everyone I know busier, and myself included. But there's a lot more opportunity for streaming. And so in the D&D live stream space, I've been much more active there, especially whether it's DMing my show or just appearing a lot as a player on others.
Tell me about those. Where can people find you? What have you been doing? And how have you liked having more control over your schedule? A lot of questions.
Yeah, no, it's been awesome. I mean, the show that I DM is called Failed Save. It's on the Pixel Circus Twitch channel, which is just twitch.tv/Pixel Circus. It's a really fun show, really cool cast. Anthony Carboni, Sage Ryan, myself, Kaylee Bray, Gina DeVivo. We have a wonderful, wonderful group of people. That's at 7 p.m. on Fridays. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, 6 p.m. on Fridays Pacific time. And yeah, that takes place in my homebrew world and then my home game as well. For the guild streams, we do those. D&D is once a month. We just had our last D&D episode this past Sunday. But besides that, we stream every Sunday just playing games, whether it's, you know, Among Us or what have you. And I just now, this past week, started my own Twitch channel, finally, after years of being told to do it. Yeah, so I'm going to have a lot of, like, gaming and tabletop RPG content on there as well, which is just my name, twitch.tv/VinceCasso.
Yay!
So, yeah.
Now, I want to know, Vince, when you play home games that are not being streamed versus when you play a game as a DM or a player for entertainment purposes, does it adjust how you play?
Oh, it's so different. It's so different. Yeah. The thing is for me, especially when I'm streaming a game, there is definitely the feeling that you want to hit the story beats. You want it to be a clean experience. You want to get the players where they want to go. And you want to all do it within a certain time constraint. You don't want to run half an hour over. Whereas with a home game, I'll be like, hey, y'all, this session might be like 3 to 5 hours. So it'll be somewhere in there. We're going to make some drinks and that's it. That's that. So, you know, there you go. But with a show, it's like, great. We have a hard out at like, the show ends at 9. If it goes past 9:15, we're just going to turn you off or whatever. The style of play is very different. And you also need to evoke a certain level of performance. Whereas at a home game, whether or not the result is very similar, it is a more relaxed environment inherently because you're not performing. You're not putting on a show. You're just doing whatever zany crap you can come up with.
You are one of the few people I've ever met when discussing D&D that was most drawn to being a DM straight out the gate. How and why is that? Because it's like basically being the team captain in every single group assignment, knowing you've got the most amount of work.
Yeah, it's a good question. For me, my background is also primarily in acting and writing. And so I enjoy the performative aspect of D&D and I enjoy the creative world building aspect. So what attracted me the most was, hey, I can just make my own world, my entire own campaign setting in which I now have, I believe it's 4 one-shots, 4 modules that are all being written and composed and the entire campaign setting itself. So that is what pulled me in the most. I don't really mind the whole idea of like the herding cats thing with players because I don't know, maybe it's just, I've been lucky, but most of my tables have been just very cooperative people who are great with the improv, the yes and, it's all very smooth. And then as an actor, I get to play every NPC. So that's my fun right there is all the fun voices I can do. And really that all attracted me more.
Yeah, Maude and I have talked about it on this show before, how if you're someone who is interested in performance, if you are a theater kid, something like that, that you're very naturally drawn to D&D for that and that there's a lot of overlapping there. You said for the guild, your agent originally got you the audition. How much traditional acting do you still do as opposed to like tabletop gaming shows?
As much as I can get. I mean, I still bill myself primarily as an actor. I am, you know, a live action voiceover actor first and foremost above all else. So that has always been the primary focus of my career. I branched into writing more recently, and more recently being like within the last 5 years, because I realized I love the creative aspect of the creation of a show, of a world as well. And so now I've got 6 TV pilots that I'm working on packaging and getting into the pitch stage. And I have the outlines for 5 feature film screenplays that I want to eventually get to. And then a whole roster of shorts that I was going to shoot this year before the pandemic hit.
Womp womp.
But so like acting, writing, if I were to sum myself up in a phrase, it would be that. Okay. But the streaming and the improv and the tabletop work has given us all the opportunity to still perform and be that in a new awesome setting.
I don't want to be a peeping Tom here, but do you have a second setup behind you? Is that when you stream and then is this where you shoot? Like, how many stations do you have?
My peep Tom's all the way. Myself and my girlfriend both stream. So that's her whole setup and rig. You can see her shelf with all her knickknacks on it and her whole streaming background. I'm here and I typically will have like a green screen up or something. And so we're sharing an office space.
What do you do for sound?
Not a lot. We suffer. We do have soundproofing along the walls. We're adding some more. And then I have a Shure SM7B mic, which does really help. The dynamic mics really help to tone out room sound. So she doesn't pick up well on this. However, because I speak at 1,000 decibels naturally, we cannot stream at the same time because her stream will become my stream.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have to schedule like chunks of time out.
Yeah, I'm more like afternoons PST and she's evenings.
Interesting. Yep.
I totally feel you on that. I have my nephew moved in with us to help us out with childcare during the day, but he streams. Right, this is his setup right over here. That's where he streams, and he does the evening weekend thing while I do the weekday thing for the most part.
And then this is where I shoot a show 5 days a week for a different network and then have to do all my streaming stuff here.
All this careful partitioning.
Yeah.
All of us making it work in a small space.
There you go.
And then I have a dog down here somewhere. Oh, she's behind me on a cushion.
Oh, cute.
Yeah.
So, Vince, you mentioned being busier in quarantine. So is it busier just because of all the additional streaming you're doing? Or are you now, like, more in development so you can really craft and put together pitches? What is making you busier since being stuck at home?
Yes. it's really all the above because... it's a combination of certain types of work really opened up this year, even though others were tightening a bit. And the fact that we were all cooped up at home for so many months, and even now still are under a lot of restriction, sort of gave me the impetus to try to do something with that time. So whether it's writing and packaging these shows or branching out as a streamer, getting so many new streams, D&D shows, what have you, moving, or what have you, you know, branching out with voiceover as well, which is still very much a booming industry right now with people inside. Mm-hmm. I built a whole studio, soundproof studio out of a closet that's just like floor to ceiling, beautiful. It felt like the time to try and make something happen. And then even outside of the fact that I'm an actor-writer primarily, I do also co-own two acting schools that operate nationally. So most of my income comes from businesses that I own. I own that, and I own six other smaller enterprises as well that generate pretty much all my income. And then everything else is just me with my freelance schedule making all the creative stuff happen.
I'm looking at Maude's face right now as you're talking about all the businesses that you own. So if people want to go to Vince Casso Acting School, where can they do that, your two acting schools?
So we have three brands right now, one that operates locally in Orlando, Florida, but is, because of the pandemic, serving a national audience, one that operates locally here in Los Angeles, and then our national brand is called Acting Dexterity. So if you did want to take acting classes taught by my father, who is a 30-year veteran in the industry, in front of and behind the camera, that is actingdexterity.com.
Cool.
I never thought I would plug that on a show like this, but yeah, there you go.
Did you stand a chance being anything else beside an actor, having your dad be a veteran?
Nah.
Yeah.
Nah. Well, funny, as a very small child, I briefly wanted to be a doctor, but it was mostly because I have no squeamishness whatsoever with the sight of blood or gore, like right in front of my face.
Whoa.
So I'm like, that's probably a good fit. That phase ended pretty quickly. But yeah, it was going to be something in the arts no matter what.
Awesome.
Yeah.
What was your, Trisha, what was your childhood sort of like dream and ambition? Like when we're kids, it's so innocent and we're like, I'm going to do this. I was going to be an orthodontist.
Oh, that's fun. Love it. Hmm. Helping everyone get beautiful smiles.
Yeah.
No, because my mum would say, I have to bloody pay $165 every 5 minutes this man has his hands in your mouth. You should do this if you want to make money. And I was like, okay.
Taking everyone's money one smile at a time.
No, couldn't believe how much it costs to have braces.
It costs so much to get braces. And I had to have them twice as a kid. I had two rounds of braces. My orthodontist, I think that was like his scheme to get more money, was like, oh, we're going to do this in two phases, phase one and phase two.
Ah, uh-huh. The bastard.
What that meant was I ended up having braces for like 5 years total, probably.
I only just now got like Invisalign for the first time because I've been needing it for most of my life and I never wanted to get braces, but it feels like this is the time.
Do it.
Yeah.
This is the time. When I was little, I wanted to be an actor. Like, from a very young age, because I think I had seen, I used to watch a ton of movies as a kid, and from the time I had seen Big, the movie with Tom Hanks, right, I was like, man, that guy gets paid to play all day. Like, all he's doing is playing with stuff, and they're paying him. That is the best job. And then I, like, put two and two together in my head that people that were in movies were just getting paid to play pretend. Like, they were just getting paid, essentially, to play house. Except for they told you what name you are and what to dress in. And I was like, this is a real getting paid to play job that exists.
Like, can you imagine, like, just what we actually do? How absurdly nice that deal is?
Right? Yeah. So that's what I was like as a little kid. Like, I'm like, man, I have my little tent and, like, my baby dolls and my action figures, and like I play with them all the time, and these are adults getting paid to essentially do the same thing. And from what I could see in my little 5-year-old brain, I was like, and getting paid pretty well and getting to wear fancy clothes and go to the Oscars, and you know, it all looked perfect to me. So from the time I was very little, I was like, ah yes, that's what I'm going to do when I grow up, despite my parents, who are a dentist and a mechanic, respectively, saying, oh, no, please, honey, you don't want to do that. No, no, why don't you study math? You know, like really trying to get me into a career that would definitely make me money instead of having me waiting tables for over a decade and living out of very, very tiny studio apartments. But that's not the life I chose. I stuck with it.
Since you were 5 years old.
Wow. Yeah. I was obsessed with Gone with the Wind. I would reenact scenes pretending I was Scarlett O'Hara. Like, I made my dad go as Rhett Butler and me as Scarlett O'Hara for a Halloween parade 1 year. Oh, and, like, as we walked past the judges, I was like, say your line, Dad. Like, I was...
When I was five, I wanted to be a mermaid.
Also,
I mean,
awesome.
It's still an option.
Also,
they're up there.
Also, on the route of like Walrus, circa Kevin Smith's movie. I mean, as long as it doesn't go like that, I'm fine.
I mean, Splash is also a Tom Hanks movie. Maybe that inspired you.
Disney Plus fucking put a skirt of hair on Daryl Hannah's bum.
I heard that
is the most devastating thing. They censored her nude run going back into the water. They put a fur. Oh, they made her hair look even longer, but it just looked like a fur skirt.
A fur butt.
So one of the first things they realized, like, people started to figure out the changes that they made. They made a change in Lilo and Stitch, apparently. They think they joked about putting a baby in a washing machine, so they changed that entire scene. Yeah.
Okay. Oh. Not for Vince. Vince is all for baby in the washing machine jokes.
It's the best bit. Oh, it's the highlight of my career are those washing baby jokes. It's all I write.
Well, this is the show of Power Up, where we are going to ask Vince what he is currently playing, watching, and reading. So let's get stuck into the playing portion of today's show. Trish is going to help us out with a little something. I don't like the look of this. What's this game?
Well, yeah, I'm playing a lot of stuff right now. One that's caught my attention much more recently, though, is Phasmophobia, which is, it dials into one of my favorite things about how culture has shifted a bit, if for bad reasons, but in a good way this year, is there's been this renaissance of, like, social and co-op games, especially as people have wanted to be able to socialize, but from home. Mm-hmm. You know, games like Among Us and Fall Guys have just taken off. And this is one that's also a lot of fun. It's a 4-player game where you basically are going into a haunting at a house or other location, and you have to collect clues and solve mysteries to find out what kind of entity is haunting this place, and also try not to die in the process because the ghosts will come out and just kill you.
You're all doing it together though, right?
Yeah, it's for a four-person team, and you're all like collaborating with different items to try and like put the clues together. It's fun.
Or you could not.
It's funny that you bring up this game, Vince, because I almost played this last night with Jovenshire and Lasercorn and Mari and a couple other friends that were on, but we had more than four players, so we opted not to play this one.
Yeah.
Because it maxes out at four, right?
It does, as far as I know.
So I've never played this. It looks absolutely terrifying, particularly that picture in the top right for anyone that's watching this, not listening to it in podcast form. Who is that guy? Is that the person coming to kill you all?
Well, so the ghosts can take multiple different forms depending on the map and the type of haunting. So sometimes it's a little girl running at you through a dark hallway. Sometimes it's some big gooey dude. It's rough. You know, you'll have EVP phenomena. They'll say shit. They'll be like the EMF readers that track the amount of haunting. And it's all very spooky. Mm-hmm. If you've ever seen like an episode of Ghost Hunters or something like that, it's that. But the ghosts do come out and do murder people.
How do you compose yourself if this is a multi co-op game and you are playing with other people? Because I would ramp up my little bitch meter, and I don't want anyone to see that.
Well, so funny enough, scary games don't get me at all. Like I don't jump, I don't get spooked. It's just I'm kind of just there for the ride. Like I'm just happy to be here, happy to be involved.
How does that exist? How does one possess that?
Are you like one of those people that laughs when you get scared? Like,
no, it's reaction? Just for me. Well, I mean, I react. I'm like, oh, that's fun. That's cool. Like, it's just for me, it's all very chill. It's part of the entertainment. It's like, I don't know. It's like watching a movie. You're like, oh, that thing happened. Oh, this guy's coming at me. That's cool. Like, yeah.
I don't know how you can keep that chill. I would be freaking out.
I'm a machine.
That's probably what makes you really good in a game like this. Because for me, when something comes running at me in a terrifying game, I'm always mouse and keyboard, right? But I get scared and I do this. And then I'm like looking in the wrong direction and I'm button mashing and trying to get away. And before I know it, I'm dead.
That makes it much funnier, though.
It's funny for streams. It's not good for beating a game.
I got to ask the chat about this because we're so split. What do you like when it comes to horror video games? Because they're immersive. And you are controlling the character in the horror. Like, you're not a voyeur. You're not watching things unfold that you cannot help. You only have one way, and that's to go through it or to stop and, I guess, walk away. But in a video game, you are playing the character, and, like, there is so much more to it. People are getting scared. Some people are saying they're a little bit like you. Himura Juba is saying he's just a manly man. So take that.
That I am not.
Well, you I had goosebumps with you telling me the premise of the game.
Now, Maud, to that, though, I ask, do you play World of Darkness tabletop RPGs, or do you play, like, Ten Candles or any of the really scary TTRPGs?
No.
For the same reason, because you don't want to go through it?
Because I'm a little bitch.
Vince, we were in the Ten Candles together for Geek and
we
Sundry.
We were! Oh, that episode was mad dark too.
It was mad. Well, it was Ivan. Ooh. And Ivan Van Norman, for those of you watching, is a wonderful dark GM and storyteller for a variety of different tabletop RPGs. But Ivan warned us ahead of time, like, this is going to be real dark. Does anybody have any issues that I should, you know, avoid certain specific things? And he was very, very good about, like, all the prep going into it. But yeah, Vince and I were in the same one shot, and it was dark.
What happened?
Yeah. Well, oh my God. So we were actually, I'll just sum up the premise real fast, but we were all on the International Space Station when this like end of the world event happened. Mm-hmm. And so we had to try to get off the station and back to Earth. Otherwise, we'll just end up eventually dying of a loss of supplies on the station, where at the same time, this entity, whatever it is trying to get its way in and try to get to us. And so over the course of the episode, we're getting a pod together. We're trying to launch so we can do like a landing back on Earth.
But something eventually infiltrates the ISS in the process. Yeah. And
something gets in. And then people start dying and killing each other. And I think I hear my wife, who's probably dead, over the radio. And it's a whole just very emotionally traumatic, which I love. I live for that stuff.
And see,
like for me.
Yeah, go ahead. For you.
No, please, please.
I was going to say, that's the reason why I asked about the difference between video games and tabletop, right? So I can play a super dark TTRPG and, like, love it. Like, I'm like you on that front. But when it comes to video games, for whatever reason, I get too scared and I freak out very easily. Maybe it's the jump scare thing, because there's not really jump scares as much in TTRPGs. It's just, like, really dark and upsetting and kind of, like, thrill and suspense.
It's a control thing.
Maybe it's a control thing.
Do you think you have more control or less control in the video game as opposed to the TTRPG?
I think you have less control in the video game.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. I honestly, like, I guess I look at them differently. The horror video games I look at similar to watching a movie, where I'm just enjoying the experience, mm-hmm. and I know that I'm playing through what is effectively an interactive film, whereas on a tabletop game, I feel so immersed, and that's the enjoyment that I get out of it, is I can experience this emotional, psychological trauma as a performer and create, just a really harsh experience, which is why I also have to be clear with people at my tables that, you know, we do the whole, like, consent sheets to begin with. We make sure everything is very, very clean, very A to B. But nonetheless, I do run very gritty, real games where things can go very, very south in a lot of ways.
Like,
and
what?
There's a few just sort of blanket rules I have at any D&D table, which is, first and foremost, matters of sexual violence and homophobia and similar things like that will just never come up. It's not part of the world, because I don't think it makes for compelling storytelling, no matter how you do it. But besides that, things whether it's the loss of family or extremely difficult dilemmas, moral choices, Pyrrhic victories, all kinds of psychologically traumatic things that involve player agency to not only force them to make a hard choice, but to also feel guilty for the result for the sake of moving story forward. As long as you're with people, players, who can maintain a bit of that aloofness from it and can tackle it as a performer, create really powerful scenes. Which is one thing I think attracts Ivan so much to the genre as well, because he's a master at creating those very, very difficult moments.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil it for anyone that didn't see it, but that episode of Ten Candles that Vince and I did, I think it still lives on the internet. Vince's death in that. So in Ten Candles, everyone dies. So I'm not spoiling anything by telling you Vince dies. Ten Candles, everyone dies. That's the way the game works. But Vince's death in particular is like...
Tell me.
It's such a bummer.
About it, I just would never want to be in it.
The moment the camera cut and we peaced out, I just started giggling. I was so happy
all
with how
us,
it went. Like,
me too. After I died, I walked off camera, and as soon as I got off camera, I had this huge smile on my face.
Yeah.
Even though I'd just been through, like, the most horrific, traumatic thing.
Well, I think it's also, for me, like, it's the catharsis, similar to the catharsis of, as a performer, you making the audience laugh. If you make them cry, if you make them cringe, if you make them uncomfortable, you are still creating that response in them. And that is ultimately my goal as a performer. So as much as most of my career has been in comedy, if I can rip your heart out as a viewer and stomp on it and make you really feel for these characters, that's the same response. The fact that you are emotionally invested in what's happening right now and really feeling something as a consequence of what happens on screen, I love creating that.
Yeah. Well, I will never be playing that video game. Thank you so much for telling us all about it. That's amazing. you did just play Among Us not so long ago, and people here are a little bit perturbed by your truth and lying kind of demeanor, I guess. But we've got more of that in a Q&A section that'll happen later. Let's move on to the watching portion of
What you watching?
Well, a couple things. This is one big one that I saw recently. Enola Holmes is a fantastic film. I mean, even just from the trailers, I was interested in checking it out. I love just all of the Conan Doyle, Arthur Conan Doyle's mythos around Sherlock Holmes to begin with, all the media surrounding it has been really special. But just having this fresh take on it and seeing Millie Bobby Brown step into a role so different from Stranger Things was a hoot. And really the whole cast, if you even just notice here from the graphic, Henry Cavill and Helena Bonham Carter and all these wonderful performers. It was an exceptional film.
I have not seen it yet. I so want to see it. But it's interesting to me. I love that you brought this up too, Vince, because I think a lot of people who've maybe only seen the trailers for this might think like, oh, this is a YA thing. Like, this is a young adult literature thing. This isn't really something for adults to enjoy. This is just for teens.
Yeah, not at all. No, it's as a certified adult, I found it immensely enjoyable. It's incredibly charming. The whole film centers around, obviously, Millie Bobby Brown, who plays the titular role here as Enola Holmes, and this conflict surrounding their mother, who she grew up in a very, very sheltered environment, whereas her brothers took off into the world. She was definitely the youngest child by a large margin, and so was raised in a very hands-on fashion by her mother, never really leaving their estate or ever experiencing the world outside until the events of the plot force her to brave the world to try to solve this mystery a little bit ahead of her brother as well. So it's a really fun film that does have a bit of that, a bit of the YA conceit in terms of this obviously teenage character who's against a much bigger foe, as in the greater world around them. But it's couched in a lot of reality and does not, it approaches empowerment for her and for her mother in a very real way, and incorporates things like racial and gender diversity in ways that not only are very applicable to our current times, but also actually really gen well with the period they're displaying. Mm-hmm. And so I thought the deft hand they took in making that work was very, very worthwhile. And it's absolutely worth seeing.
Awesome. I love Henry Cavill.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of all I want to say.
I love The Witcher.
Oh, love that. I don't especially love Millie Bobby Brown in this. I love that she's got her original accent back, because we all know her as 11 and she's American in that, but she's actually not. But I have really enjoyed the comparisons that have been made between this and Fleabag. The whole breaking of the fourth wall moments, how, you know, it's focused on a female character and the relationship with her siblings and family and mother. And I really liked that comparison. Albeit, I am only a third of the way through the movie. But have you seen Fleabag at all?
I actually have not seen Fleabag, but it's interesting that you mentioned that narrative style, because that is one thing that I also really liked, is in that Fleabag or, like, you know, Ferris Bueller-esque style, the character's inner monologue is in her conversations with the viewer. That's the way that she thinks through things or explains what she's feeling, is we have a chance to see the character's inner monologue as you would in a novel, but it's by her having conversations with the people watching, which is super interesting. I like that.
That's what an ENFP will do.
Mod's still on it. Still on the Myers-Briggs.
Myers-Briggs.
I have not seen Enola Holmes yet. I was one of the people that was pretty confused and thought it was a series, not a movie. But they're trying to make it into a miniseries, so it would be a miniseries
that
of
would be great.
Movies, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the plan. I still haven't seen it, but it's definitely on my to-watch list. People don't know what it is, because kind of Maude and I came into it with an understanding of what Enola Holmes is and what it's about, what would be your, like, elevator pitch for it?
Oh, good question. Yeah. The equally gifted younger sister of Sherlock Holmes has to attempt to solve a mystery against significant adversity that even her brother cannot think himself around. Is really how it sums up.
I like that. Have you seen other Sherlock Holmes properties?
Sorry?
Have you seen other Sherlock Holmes properties?
Yes. Most of my grounding in it, aside from some of the audiobooks that I listen to while I work out and stuff, is from the BBC show, which is, I'm a huge fan of the BBC series. Cumberbatch is just
so good.
Like, what can you say?
And
like,
Freeman. He's Cumberbatch amazing. And Freeman?
Yeah, it's an unbelievable pair. Also, very, very contrary to the relationship they have in the books. Mm-hmm. Even his own betrayal of Holmes is not really like the Holmes from the novels, but just it became its own thing, and it's fantastic. Like, he kills it.
And I think the difference is, like, Enola, it sounds like she has to vocalize her inner thoughts, whereas Sherlock, he would start visualizing and take kind of like notes and numbers and memories, and they would form in front of him, which obviously no one else can see, but that explains how his mind works. And I loved that side of it.
Yeah.
Because he's just so logical. But he was just so, I mean, he was Spectrum City, which I absolutely loved as well, where it's like his mind worked in a very, very unique way. And his matter-of-factness and lack of sort of empathy or understanding of sort of like tact was really fascinating. I really liked that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's fun.
Absolutely agreed. All right, so that's what Vince says we should be watching right now. Vince, what should we be reading?
That's a good question. Well, yeah, one book that I've just started in on and digging into a bit is called The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz, which is a fascinating book. If I were to chalk it up to any genre, it would be of the self-help bent, but it's more, if you approach it more as a philosophical treatise, then that gives you a lot of an understanding of what this is trying to get across, which is, hey, here are some thoughts on ways in which you can live better yourself. You can promote styles of thinking and a lifestyle that is healthier for you mentally, which thus will benefit those around you as well by the effect you create on them. And the four agreements themselves really break down they're all summed up in a sentence, but then they all go into much more detail. Agreement number one is be impeccable with your word, which, again, he goes into a lot of examples and details thereof, like subdivisions thereof. Agreement two, don't take anything personally, which itself has a lot of breakdowns. Agreement three, don't make assumptions. And then agreement four, always do your best. And these sound kind of generic, kind of boilerplate, like, yeah, that sounds like good stuff. But he gives a lot of very good examples and sort of subdivisions of how each of those can apply to life, how they all break down, and how they really affect your thinking. Mm-hmm. Which affects your behavior and affects the way that others respond to you as well.
I see Zanubis in chat put the four in there just as you were starting to say them.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
There are other fans of the four agreements in chat. Thank you guys for putting that in and letting us know that you also read it.
I just had a tip with my mom before because she made an assumption and I went, stop doing that. I have to apologize because I want to be impeccable with my word. I love this kind of stuff. I think that the biggest thing about being in a mandatory sort of lockdown and having a lot of time in the same space over and over again is that you can't distract yourself. And I'm very, very good at distracting myself from sort of like the things that I don't want to think about or moving on or not going too deep with it all.
Sure.
And the last sort of 6 months, I've really had to sit with some uncomfortable feelings and things that I don't necessarily like and then understand them. So I have, I think this is the first time ever in like, 20 plus years of reading that I've delved into things that don't have dragons or magic. And it's got its own form of magic. But I've been really, I think you have to be open to wanting to learn. And now that I am, all these kind of books are blowing my freaking mind. And I'm really loving them. Yeah. What is something that you've kind of taken and applied already with this book?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because for me, I think all of us can look at the four agreements or look at examples that he gives and feel like, okay, well, like, you know, I already try and do that kind of stuff. Like, I already knew that. But there's a certain self-reflection that really comes into play where you sit down and you say, you know what? I know that I can be prickly when people bring up X or Y or Z. And I know that even if they are ill-intentioned, even if they are being a bit, you know, about it, I cannot necessarily control what they say, but I can absolutely control the way that I feel about it because they don't have some magic remote control that changes my emotions or changes my feelings. That's entirely a choice that I make. And while some situations can be harder to respond to positively than others, we can take it upon ourselves and say, hey, you know what? Perhaps crappy thing someone else is doing is merely a reflection of them. That does not have to be something that also brings me down and something that instead maybe I can inject some positivity into and resolve with them, because for all I know, their intentions are not bad either. So that's, you know, not taking anything personally, being impeccable with the world, not making assumptions. It's just realizing that at the end of the day, all people on a very fundamental level, the sheer bulk of us, are basically good. We're all just trying to work together and cooperate to make a better world. Some people can make choices along that line that create more destruction than construction, but those people can also be worked with, reasoned with, talked to try to get us all back on the same path, because that's where we're headed. We're all trying to work together to get there. So why fight on the way there if we don't need to?
I love it. You know, it's interesting. There's a lot of books that I've read like this. I know I've talked about on the show before, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, which is one of my favorite books, that's in a similar vein to, you know, the heading seems very obvious. And you're like, well, yes, everybody knows that. But by the time they kind of walk you through examples of it and how people's minds naturally go to some of these places, they've almost, like, they've arrived from this simple statement to a much more complex kind of life philosophy that now that you've read it, you can associate with that simple statement. He's just not that into you does the exact same thing, but to great comedic effect, I think, if anyone's ever read that book, where, you know, he's just not that into if he doesn't call you. Okay, well, that seems real obvious. However, three pages later, you're like, oh, we've all done that.
We all need a reminder once in a while.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think these are all wonderful books that we can really take from. I see a lot of people in chat saying, I feel like I would really like to read this. Another funny assumption that I've heard is that it's when you hit your 30s that everyone wants to read self-help books.
Well, I mean, I think your 20s is all about like learning by doing. Like, you're so busy sort of living your life and making the mistakes and just not figuring out the whys, but the whats and the whos and all that kind of stuff, that when you get to your 30s, you're like, okay, now I'm noticing patterns, or now I'm like, I keep running into the same walls. So I need to learn more than my experience has allowed. And I actually need to look for answers to explain.
And also, hopefully, as you experience the world, as you grow up, you do become increasingly self-aware in that, hey, I recognize that I may have faults of my own. I recognize that there are things in which I can improve that are very much subjective and not object factors of my life, like I want more money or whatever. No, it's there's things that I want to work on about me that perhaps I didn't notice in my early 20s because I'm just kind of flying through life. But now I'm like, hey, I want to be my best me. If you are arriving at that sort of, you know, realization, then good. If not and you're perfect now, well, awesome. But most of us are not.
That is an interesting thing, because there are some people I'm noticing in my life that I'm attracting more people that have a growth mentality, that do want to reflect and do want to learn a little bit more and are open to sort of like discussions on and feedback. And I'm butting heads with people that cannot have these sort of candid conversations and get a little bit precious about it, or they're happy just the way they are and nothing's wrong with them, everything's wrong with you. And you're like, wait a second, meet me halfway, and it doesn't happen. Did that happen to me today? Yes.
I'm sorry, Maud.
Oh no.
That's okay.
Not here. This is a loving circle right here. Yeah. Everyone's here to listen.
But they don't think anything's wrong with them. And I'm like,
yeah, well, we've all met those people for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it takes time. I mean, I know some people who, into their 50s and 60s, they had their worldview, they had their way of seeing and doing things, until one day, whatever the inciting event might have been, they sat back and decided, okay, maybe I wasn't totally right about all this to begin with. And we're all on that journey. Mm-hmm. There's no race to the finish line. It's not a contest. But ideally, that is the direction we're all moving. And if you recognize in yourself that you are perhaps not on that road, it might be time to consider hopping on board.
Right. Is this the type of book you normally find yourself drawn to, or is this kind of an outlier from what you normally read?
I study a whole mix of business. Everything from, you know, texts on philosophy. Like a recent one of mine was also Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. Another fantastic work on Stoicism. I study history extensively, especially ancient history, theology, theosophy, biblical scholarship from a historical point of view, And I mean, like, the scholarship, like, the published peer-reviewed works and all that. Mm-hmm. Comparative religion, all things like that, that helped to give me... My focus is developing the most embracive possible concept of the human mind, the human condition, where we have been, and thus where we are going, and how to ensure that road stays as focused and direct and efficient along that path as possible.
I heard a word in there that sounded made up because I think it's the first time I'm hearing it, and that was theosophy?
Yeah, theosophy. So,
what is that?
Let me get you a good definition for that.
Theology and philosophy, right? That's where you got theosophy? Yeah.
So this is more of a religious term as opposed to theology, it's a philosophy that maintains that knowledge of God or of higher states might be achievable through direct intuition or sort of like religious or enlightenment kind of methods. And so I've studied a lot of practices and a lot of philosophies that do focus on things such as, hey, you could have a direct revelation of these things, whether it's from Buddhist texts that believe you can achieve nirvana via meditation, enlightenment, what have you, or whether it's Western occultism that had its own very ritualistic practices to achieve certain forms of enlightenment. I'm always extremely interested in how do people think they can get better? How do people think they can come to learn more? And how can they actually do so? What has been the mode through which we've attempted that in history? And where as a culture has that gotten us over time? So all these questions I'm very interested in answering.
I have a question about
learning. I know it's a lot.
Yeah, learning that much. How do you retain that kind of information? Because I find myself, like, I read a series of books that are 12 deep kind of thing. And then after 3 years, I'm like, I completely forget what that story was. I remember liking it, but I can't remember anything about it. So I'll read it again. How do you retain this kind of information?
I think for me, it's a combination of two factors, or I should say three. It's number one, there is repetition involved. I sometimes will go over certain concepts, periods of history, what have you, multiple times, which really helps to seat them in. Number two is finding actual, kind of like when you're developing like mnemonic patterns, what have you, to memorize things. It's finding ways in which these things apply to my life or the world around me, actually creating intentional associations in my mind with other things mm-hmm. that I already know, which mm-hmm. gives that information context and thus locks it into my mind. And the third thing, and this might sound obvious, but you'd be surprised how much this enters in, is while studying a text, I make sure that I understand in depth, by actual definition, every single word that I'm reading. Because to the degree that I'm going past words that I just have no concept of or terms that I've never heard before, the entire text begins to lose meaning. And it starts to kind of fall away in your memory. So look, it takes me a while sometimes. I'll sit back and I'll read a page. Wait, I don't know what this means. Hang on. I got to go, like, I'll go look it up. Okay, good. Here's how it can work in this context. Okay, I get it. And then continue on to really get that in-depth grasp.
Well, and I found that especially when you're reading theological stuff. So I was a theology minor in college. And like when I first started, it took me so long to read anything because I feel like I'd have to look up every third word.
There's so much stuff.
Because it's all just theological jargon that theologians are used to using so they can spout around. But by the time I got to probably my second or third semester in that minor, those words were now commonplace for me and I could rip through them. Now, that being said, it's been a long time since I studied that. So I'm sure if I got back into reading theology and those type of documents, I would be right back to square one with having to look something up every 2 seconds. But yeah, once you kind of get into the groove, it's like any industry has its own specific jargon and you just need to become familiar with it if you're really going to become adept in that space.
Yeah, it's a field. Like it's a field like any other and mm-hmm. each field definitely has its own vernacular. But even still, like I'll be reading a book written, one author that I read frequently is Bart Ehrman, who writes a lot of New Testament scholarship, approaching the stories from the Bible from a critical historical point of view. Like what can this tell us about history and the people involved at the time? And I'll still come across terms and references and I'm like, okay, I don't know what the hell that just was. And I'll have to dig into that for an hour. But yeah, it's fun. It's cool to get that viewpoint on things.
Back when I was 23 and I had a lot of time, so I got into reading quite a lot, I would have a notebook next to me, and every time I came across a word I didn't know, I would look it up and I would write it in the book, and then I would write the definition, and then I would write like kind of the use of it in a sentence with like whether it was a noun or a verb. And I ended up filling all these pages that every now and then I would go back over and be like, these were great words, how can I use them?
Awesome. My words.
Yeah,
I did that with musical theater. I always wanted to sing along with and like perform musical theater, and if there was a word in a song I didn't know, how could I perform it if I didn't know what that word meant? So, like, I very specifically remember The Lion King, like Disney's The Lion King, trying to know all of the words in Be Prepared. In Scar's song, Be Prepared. Like, I know that your powers of retention. I was like, what is retention? Yeah. Like, there's so many words. The monarchy he talks about. Yeah. There were so many words in that song that, like, I had to look up in order to be able to dramatically.
He also used the term quid pro quo.
We're 8 years old being like, what?
Yeah, as a child, I'm like, quid pro quo, what's that even mean? What is that? Some noises, some sounds. All right.
Mine was Beauty and the Beast with Belle in this poor provincial town.
Provincial.
Yeah, I'm like, I still don't really.
I had the same thing because I did a performance of Macbeth last year. I didn't even have like a massive role, but definitely chunky enough. And I'm reading the strip, and we did it in original prose. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, I should probably know what I'm talking about. So I'm going to go look up 300 Shakespearean terms now.
Can you got a favorite one that you can remember still?
Oh, no. Oh, boy. Let's see. What did I say?
I'm just putting
holy cow. Yeah, please. It's been a while now. That's a good question. So let's see. Honestly, no. Most of it's escaping me now. But funny enough, I still know some of those scenes, like bits and pieces by heart. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was just because at a certain point as an actor as well, like studying that script, I'm like, I'm at the point where, honest to God, I don't even know how, like what emotion I'm supposed to have with this sentence. Like, am I saying a good thing or a bad thing? Mm-hmm. Like, is this good news? I don't know. Okay, so Norway is coming. That sounds bad.
Is it a person? Is it the country? Is it the army of the country? Yeah.
Yeah, Matt Milder in chat says, Shakespeare's rough if you don't know what everything means. And that's the truth.
So in high school, we had to study in English a lot of what Shakespeare meant. And I remember just being so resentful of Shakespeare to the point where I would want to put more energy building a time machine to go back to end Mr. Williams' life, to have to not study it than to go through it. And it's just, it's marred me completely. But like, and then there's like another thing where I had to do a course on interpreting Shakespeare. And I was like, thus ends my life.
I was describing, I believe it was Macbeth himself. And I described him as that Bellona's bridegroom, lapped in proof. And I'm like, what the hell did I just say?
Bellona's bride? I'm thinking of like deli meat in a veil.
Lapped in proof?
Yeah, but it was supposed to be saying like, it was something like this, like the groom of this god of war, who's like, as in very talented and capable in warlike things, is like, and confronting him with self-comparisons, rebellious arm against arm, et cetera, et cetera. So it's about like the fact that they're fighting and matching power and strength. And I had to dig through this whole thing for hours. I read a modern English translation next to the original Shakespeare for the entire script, just to try and get a grasp of what the hell we were talking about. But thankfully, if you do that and you really sell the moment, I had audience members coming up afterwards saying like, hey, you were one of the only cast members who we really actually understood, because we didn't even know what the words were, but the way that you said them made it obvious what you were talking about. And so you can kind of piece together from context. I'm like, oh, thank God. I'm glad.
Yeah, that's my theater degree was a classical theater degree. So like all Greek and Shakespeare that I studied in college. Because, you know, that's a degree that's going to get you money and jobs. It's not. It's not at all. But that's the one thing they always told us with Shakespeare is you 100% have to know what you're saying. You need to know what you're saying inside out and backwards, or else the audience will have zero idea what you're saying.
Oh, yeah.
But once you know it, then exactly what you said, Vince, you can use your inflection and your emotions, and you can really perform it in a way that people will understand.
Yeah.
Some of the best improv I have ever seen And it's like, it's the most impressive thing because they made it look effortless. But it was an improv group, I believe, called the Shakespeare Group, where they, on the spot, are given a title and they perform a Shakespearean-esque type improv play with like three freaking acts over the course of like an hour and a half that is all on the spot and using iambic pentameters.
Iambic pentameter.
I knew I wasn't going to get it. But that's how they speak. And they use like the Shakespearean kind of really complex.
That's freaking wild.
That's wild.
Improv. And like, I barely know it. And you know, I was going to time travel to kill fucking Will Shakespeare. But watching these guys duke it out was the most impressive thing I've ever seen. I'm like, I was soaring afterwards. So if you can look, I want to be able to sing their praises. But like every single show they do is sold out like instantly because they are so.
I bet.
But it was so thoroughly entertaining. But every single time they improv a concept or like a way to further the play, they had to rhyme. Ah. Oh.
So, like even just speaking in meter, like for the sake of doing the play with a script I already knew, by the way, was a challenge in itself. Like, I memorized the words. I knew what I was saying, mm-hmm. but you've got to say them with that careful freaking rhythm. I'm like, oh, that's amazing.
I remember in college having to go through line by line and mark the emphasis on my iambic pentameter lines so that you knew how to say it, which was like fine for a sonnet, but then you get a whole play and it's like, oh.
Very pretty to listen to, though. Like it does give it gives the words a musicality that's a lot of fun.
I wish I could find this group, the Shakespeare group or something. It was, guys, like it was mind blowing, and everyone needs to see them before you die. Like,
find them. While Maud is trying to find the Shakespeare group, folks in chat, please go ahead and get in your questions for Vince for Bomb Q&A. Get those questions coming and we'll pop into that soon.
Yeah, I got some.
Yes.
Woohoo.
Oh, everyone's posting about the 10 candles.
Oh yeah.
It was gritty. I'm pretty sure everyone in that 10 candles play session 2 hated my character, which is always really fun for me in TTRPGs because, I don't know, I feel like normally I tend to be like the sweet, good one that helps everybody. So when I get to be the villain or like just the annoying one or whatever, like the thorn in everyone's side, it's real fun.
At a certain point, I was definitely like, you know what? I hate doing this to other players, but I probably should try and kill her or something. Like she seems like a pretty big threat. Like we're all going to die if she stays here.
Maybe. Pretty fun.
Some of the questions I've got coming through, Caitlin, who you just played among us.
Oh, hey, Caitlin, the forever imposter.
Exactly. They ask you, lol, I'm playing with him right now, and he's so good at this game. Tell them Caitlin wants him to teach them how to play. How are you really good at lying? Because I suck at Mafia as well. And anytime someone's like, oh, you're Mafia, and I'm not, I immediately sound and feel and act guilty. But I'm not. And I'm like, just get rid of me. I told you so. And like, no one wins when that happens. So what are the techniques?
I'll tell you, my favorite game probably ever, if we're referring to like in-person, like board games and stuff, my favorite ever game of all time is Werewolf. So I was raised on Werewolf, Murder, Mafia, all those social deduction games. And so I've been playing them constantly since I was like 10 years old. Just nonstop. That said, though, for me, it's approaching it like an improv scene. Like it's approaching it like a skit in that I know that I need to maintain no discernible pattern of difference between when I'm innocent and when I'm guilty. I know that when I am guilty, I need to not only make kills that are fortuitous for me for the sake of advancing my goals, but kills that tactically make other people suspicious to both openly and insidiously cast blame on others or to get other people to bicker and infight and take attention away from me. It's all very heavy stuff, but that is playing the game at a very high level, is doing that kind of stuff.
I don't. Awesome. I don't like that.
I have a question here from Twitch chat from Ashalon6023. Says, any suggestions for a person getting ready to play an evil campaign in D&D, but is having a hard time even coming up with a character?
Evil campaigns are tricky. And for me, it always comes down to you having a conversation with your DM about the world, about the story, because it's easy for an evil campaign because the characters are inherently going to be malicious and or typically chaotic to stay like sensical mm-hmm. without just having it like there's no good reason why the town guard wouldn't just bloody come after you, why you wouldn't this, wouldn't that. So make sure that the campaign is couched in a certain logically evil reality where you're not trying to be an ordinary D&D party but evil, but that the campaign is evil from start to finish and that you have that setting to back you up. If you do have that, any character you want with malicious intent or a nasty backstory would fit, but the reverse is not true. If the setting does not really permit evil behavior with flexibility, mm-hmm. no character is going to work in it.
I've got a question here from Maud Garrett. She says, we built a campaign together in a one-shot on Satine's GM Tips. If you're making a homebrew game, have you stolen all the amazing... ideas that we built together, and did it get to see the light of day?
That's so funny. What's funny is it was actually a little bit of the reverse. A few of the elements that I added to that one shot were from a character backstory that I wrote for myself for a game that I was playing in.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I just thought from the book that I was reading, so we were.
I haven't worked that specific conceit into a game yet, although it was a very strong story. So I think, and I still remember the whole thing, so I think it'd be fun to work in.
I think we'd have a season 6 of Dungeons and Flagons too. Nathan here, Nathan's pop in the chat says, do you prefer homebrew settings or the official D&D settings? And I know that we talked about the fact that you immediately jumped into making your own homebrew, but has there been things in the official D&D setting that you have discovered and been like, oh, this is actually really sick? Because I'm a bit the same where I wanted to do all my own stuff. And then people would start talking to me about Baldur's Gate and Waterdeep and all these things. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And then been like, oh, this is all like a full fleshed out world.
Yeah, it's a good question. I'll say that I have played about maybe 6 sessions of a Waterdeep campaign. I did thoroughly enjoy it. I do like the Forgotten Realms, Faerun. I love everything they've built for that world. As someone who's beyond anything else a creative, it's hard for me to step out of that world that I've built because I see so much opportunity for storytelling that has never before been experienced. And I love to create those unique experiences. That said, though, I definitely borrow certain specific bits from Forgotten Realms lore. For example, there's the whole backstory around Mystra and around the weave that is the foundation of all magic in the Forgotten Realms, and how this goddess locked away the ability to cast epic magics, very, very high tier 10, 11, and 12th level magics, and that whole sort of backstory. And because I really loved that bit of lore, a similar version of that was incorporated into my world in terms of why and how epic level magics of 10th, 11th, and 12th level became inaccessible and what those represent in the deep backstory of the world. So I definitely borrow certain ideas and concepts, but beyond that, I love working within the history of my world.
Mm. I found the Improv Shakespeare Company. I put it in the chat before. Improvised Shakespeare. It's called the Improvised Shakespeare Company. And
beautiful.
Thomas Middleditch was a member. So I guess Thomas Middleditch, who does now Middleditch and Schwartz, which is the hardest duo to say when you're me.
Middleditch and Schwartz. Woo.
Yeah, well, okay. Well done.
It didn't come out cleanly. My mic made that sound good.
A lot better. I've been attempting. Thank you for saving me. But obviously, he's one of the best improv performers on the planet at this stage. And the comedy that he does with Ben Schwartz is great. But this is like probably the hardest thing that you could improvise, and how and the fact that they have songs in there that they make up on the spot as well. Like, my goodness. So if you can get a show, but I do have the link in there. I can't sing their praises enough. It was just, you know, when you meet someone or you see a performance and you're like, you are just so brilliant that I'm just going to go home and bathe in your glory, but also rethink my life. Like, it was that. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
I have a question here from Sprinkles the Dragon Cat in Twitch chat. Says, Vince, what acting role do you want the most? And if you're unable to get it, would you create it?
okay, so I have a general and a specific answer to that. My specific answer is I'd love to play fucking Gambit because I can do all of the card tricks as well. I can, yes! I do magic.
Yes!
I do card flourishing and all that. And that and Leon Kennedy from Resident Evil 2, when my hair is longer, obviously. Those are two roles that I'm like, I would love to get those so bad. Then generally, even though those are both... What?
You have cards there. I'm the perfect audience member for card tricks. I'm so receptive and love them a lot.
I also love that Vince is just like, hold on, do I have cards right here?
Hang on, it's right here. Yeah, so magic does not translate well over webcam, but I can do all kinds of fun, like, little tricks and movements and stuff. I've been doing magic and card manipulations and what have you since I was, like, I think 13 years old. So all kinds of fun tricks like that. Yeah, so... I love that kind of stuff. It's a lot of fun. But then, look at Mon, you're so excited.
I know, I love it. How do you do that?
Years of practice and lots of dropped cards. But then I think the general answer to that would be, as much as those two roles are very much more of the suave, almost leading man type, roles that I really enjoy playing on a general basis are also the very heavy character, kind of twisted and just messed up, horrible people, because I love to explore those darker sides of humanity, darker psychological motivations, and like I said, to create a visceral reaction in the viewer. So I also very much like that kind of nasty stuff.
Yeah, because you're super desensitized and it doesn't seep into your soul and make you feel sad.
No bleed, baby.
I can vouch though, playing the evil characters can be really fun. One of my favorite roles I ever did on stage was it was a melodrama villain, which anytime you get to play in melodrama, it's like so juicy and over the top and you can really go wild with it. But just getting to play someone whose mind and motivations are so completely different than my own was just a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So much fun. So Matt Milder says, so would you like to play a serial killer in a TV series or movie?
Absolutely. Oh, you drop me into like Mindhunters or something as a serial killer, I would be all over that.
So good.
It's so good and so scary.
I don't think that's scary. I think that's fascinating.
It's fascinating, but also if I watch like two episodes before bed, I'm done. I'm not sleeping that night.
I also love in the evil vein of characters, I love playing characters who are not one note evil, like just cackling, mustache twirling, stabby, stabby villains. I like playing just the psychologically broken people, either the psychologically broken people who do evil from compulsion or obsession, and perhaps even know what they're doing is wrong and have that internal conflict, which is fun to play, or people who are so absolutely convinced they are the good guys, which is really what any evil character should fundamentally be. But people who operate by their convictions and who even as the viewer, you sit back and you're like, does he have a point?
Yeah, he's like,
yeah.
I love that kind of stuff.
For Ashelon, Ashelon in chat is said what Trisha just said is my problem with the evil character. I would say go with what Vince said. You know, try to put yourself looking as your character through a lens where you are the hero of your story. Either your lens is tinted. Like for my character in that play, the lens that I chose for that character was that she never gets what she wants. And everything is fueled by this detesting kind of hatred for I never get what I want. I've never been given what I deserve in this world. And so everything she did was motivated by that, even though objectively looking at it, she got a lot of what she wanted. In her mind, she never did. So all of her actions were completely justified because this was like the one time that she deserved it. So if you can give yourself a colored lens or you can give yourself a motivation that ultimately, you know, think of it like a Thanos where you're like, yes, a lot of bad stuff's going to happen, but the end justifies the means, and I'm the hero that's going to take everybody to this end. Again, if you can think of yourself as the hero, that's a good way to do it, too. You got this.
Everyone is the hero of their own story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
That was a really enlightening power up. I'm like trying to figure out what a really good title for this to go up on VOD tomorrow. It's like how to be a better person. How to be an evil person. How to be an evil person.
How to be all kinds of folks.
Yeah, with Vince Casso. It's perfect. Well, Vince, thank you so much for being on the show today. This has been 100% lovely. Thank you so much for having me. And tell people where they can find you and what you're working on and where to follow you in all the places.
Yeah, well, first and foremost, like I said on the top as well, I recently launched my Twitch channel for the first time ever after a long delay of not doing that. So I'm starting a full-time content schedule starting next week. If you can go to twitch.tv/VinceCasso and just pop me a follow, it's super appreciated. And I'm going to be... What was that?
I just did.
Oh, thank you, Mom. Yeah, I'm going to be streaming all kinds of games, both multiplayer games, RPGs, TTRPGs, all kinds of fun stuff starting next week. And then I'm on Instagram and Twitter as well, at Vince Casso, same handle everywhere. And you can catch me as the DM of the show Failed Save on twitch.tv/PixelCircus Fridays at 6 p.m. Pacific.
Well, nicely done. If someone calls you Vincent, are you in trouble? Or
they die. No, I'm sorry. Totally fine. Yeah. I've been called Vincent Vin, Vinny Vincenzo. It's Vinny the Cheese because people mispronounce my last name Queso instead of Casso. So I make the joke that my name's Vinny the Cheese.
I like that.
Vinny the Cheese has to be like your mafioso name.
It really is. He's not a high level mobster.
Yeah, no. Where is he, Vinny? Which one? Vinny the Cheese.
It's a cheese. Wait, where's the cheese at?
Oh, cut the cheese. Yeah. I'm watching Fargo again, so it's like
oh wonderful.
So good.
Think I'm gonna barf. I love that movie so much.
Vince is gonna stick around and join us for Power Down as well. So yeah. If you are a Geek Bomber backer and you have access to Power Down, you will see the chat that shall ensue after this. But that wraps us up for Power Up. Thank you everybody so much for watching. Yay!
Thanks, y'all.
Before we jump to end screen, I do want to thank, since notifications are off, for the recording of Power Up so that we can port this into podcast form and it can eventually go and live on Geek Bomb. I want to say a huge thank you to, let's see, Codemon09 and Balder75 and Classy Librarian. So Codemon09 for the resub, Balder75 for the resub, Classy Librarian for the raid and kicking it off. Thank you, everyone who followed Zraken75 for gifting 10 subs on the channel today. Thank you so much for that generous, generous gift. And welcome to the Dragon Riders, everyone. Disco Cobra 2013 gifted a sub as well. Thank you so much, Disco Cobra and Matt Milder. Welcome to the Dragon Riders. Let's see. Lil Alive Thee, I believe is how you say your name, also gifted a sub. Thank you so much for gifting a sub. And welcome Aquamarine Mojo to the Dragon Riders. Hi, honey. Thank you so much. Welcome to the Dragon Riders. Thank you for the sub. Foo2099, thank you for the resub for 55 months. Gosh, this channel's been around a long time. And Kazmike1966, thank you for the resub as well. A happy half a subiversary. And thank you, everyone, who joined for the first time today and gave a follow so that you can check out when other cool things are happening on this channel. All right, so we are going to sign off. Thank you all so much for being here. And let's see. Next time I am going to be live is probably Sunday, which is going to be a big charity stream with a bunch of giveaways, so you're not going to want to miss it.
Oh, fine.
And that's going to be Sunday morning.
I'm going to be next live tonight after this.
Oh, are you going live for the gameplay tonight? Or is it a different thing?
Oh, I was supposed to be doing that, aren't I? I just don't know if I'll enjoy it.
All right, well, we'll talk about that later. I also might be live tonight, maybe. It's a big maybe. I don't know. But big charity stream Sunday morning with Twitch front page and everything. So it's going to be a good time. Make sure you join in.
Yay.
Okay,
and then
bye.
Good night, Dungeons. Yay.
Bye, everybody.